Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Welcome to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Hi there, and thanks a lot for joining me again today. I really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Lots to talk about coming up, including an explanation of some surprise findings and a new study about the effectiveness of colonoscopies. We'll also hear about one of the effects of a stroke, auditory processing problems. And we'll get an update on flu shots and COVID boosters. But first, let's start the show the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchold. Dr. Buchold is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchold, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Oh, Fred, you know it's always my pleasure.
Earlier this week, we heard from Pfizer that they've got some results now on how their updated COVID booster is faring. What are we finding?
Well, yeah, just a slight background, Fred. Just the CDC and FDA have made recommendations of boosters for this winter. And, you know, I think to some degree of, I don't know if controversy is the right word, but just the decision was made without a lot of great evidence. So it was more kind of a what I would call an educated guess. Now, I say that trying to be clear. I'm not critical of that. It's hard when you're kind of going through, whether or not we're still in a pandemic or not, I guess is still a debate. But certainly you're worried about a spike in cases over the winter and you don't have a lot of data in front of you. So sometimes you just have to make a best guess. But one of the criticisms was that of that decision was that there wasn't a lot of human trial evidence to, basically studies involving humans showing whether or not the vaccines were first safe and be effective. So Pfizer's kind of put out that information. Now, it's not publicly available yet, so I think that's the other part. This is just kind of what Pfizer's saying. But to the newer variants, and what's most interesting about this is what's called a bivalent shot. And what that means basically is it's a combination of the vaccine that was originally created, so like kind of the original COVID vaccine, so to speak, and then others designed to kind of protect the more common variants, which include the more recent Omicron variants, BA4 and BA5. So it showed that it's safe. It showed it's effective. You know, I think kind of this has kind of been the habit we've been seeing with these drugs, but it doesn't tell us whether or not the degree of protection that you get. But it stands to reason, and the evidence and our experience has shown is that when you have vaccines, you certainly are less likely to get COVID. And if you do get COVID, you're much more likely have much more mild disease. And more data is coming from that, Fred. I mean, it's not where we're seeing this is a clear fact, but it's certainly within reason to say that this provides a good degree of protection and prevention of severe illness. And that's what's really important, particularly for our at-risk population, you know, above the age of 55, those with other kind of chronic diseases, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I saw some warnings from doctors this week about something I think we've talked about Paxlovid and how it can impact common heart medications. I know you say this is a hard one to prescribe. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, we've talked a lot about this in our group with my partners because, we've set up almost like a telephone clinic for this because it takes so much time that we feel like we just need to sit with the patient and do a quick telephone visit to kind of make sure what medications are taking to reconcile that, so to speak, and then understand side effects and decide whether or not to keep certain medicines. So the big worry is with a lot of medicines, particularly ones that people are on in high numbers in the United States. So statins, which are, drugs like Lipitor and Crestor and Zocor, which are used to either prevent heart disease or to treat heart disease. So they're very, very common, often have a lot of effects when you get Paxlovid, or a lot of side effects, or it changes the amount, the potential toxicity of your liver when you take Paxlovid. And then a lot of what we call our blood thinning medicines, although that's not a perfectly correct term, but drugs like Xarelto or Pradaxa or Eliquis that a large number of patients are on for a variety of different reasons, also have interactions with Paxlovid. So trying to decide if you need to keep those on, if you need to take them off, what to watch for. There's just a lot of decisions that have to be made if we decide to prescribe it. The other part to this, too, is you hear me talk, Fred, ad nauseum about risk and benefit. And Paxlovid, I think, with high-risk patients, you know, so those are particularly susceptible to getting the COVID infection and having consequences of that, you know, being hospitalized, being in ICU, certainly have a benefit. We don't know what that benefit is when they're vaccinated very well. And for lower-risk patients, that it doesn't have much of that much of a benefit. It reduces symptoms a little bit, but then there's that rebound that we see. We saw President Biden who had that. You know, generally, I unless people are really feeling bad, I when I get called about this, I most of the times I say, you know, I'm not sure this is a wise decision to take it. And everybody's case is different, and every physician is a little bit different in this. But that's kind of where I've kind of gone with this, just because it's, I don't know if you're getting your bang for your buck, particularly when you're having to rearrange a bunch of drugs and then remember to take them again. It's hard enough to get people to take medicine sometimes in the first place, long term. It's just another complication and cumbersome that I'm not sure is really necessary sometimes.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Did you see that new study that came out this week about long COVID and its many long-lasting effects?
Yeah, it's interesting, Fred. We've talked a couple times about some other long COVID studies, particularly the ones that are coming out of actually our local veterans hospital. There's a group there. And, you know, to be kind to these investigators, and including this survey, is that this is a hard problem to tease out. This study that came out of, it's out of Scotland, is a survey study. And the issue with surveys, just like there is with political polls, is that you have to have participation. And the people that participate are likely have, I use the word bias, but it's not the way that we kind of think of it commonly. But it's just like the type of person that's going to respond to the survey is the type of person that's already having symptoms. If people had COVID and they feel fine, they may be less inclined because they don't have an axe to grind, so to speak. So it's hard to kind of interpret this data other than like kind of generating a good idea or what I call a hypothesis. And this is kind of an also issue of just when you deal with a lot of patients, like getting this information is very challenging. But I do think that there is this notion that long COVID it is probably a thing, and it probably comes in a myriad of forms. How we go about it or think about it is, I think, really fraught. But this is to say, just kind of describe the experiences of a lot of people. They tended to have symptoms for 3 to 6 to 9 months, some even longer. There's some association with the severity of disease, which makes a lot of sense. But the real important trials, the NIH is conducting one. I think there's also one out of New York that has done some work where, like, they identified a number of people right as they got infections and just kind of watched them over time. And those are really the most important studies to do. They're expensive and they're hard, but can really kind of detect really important patterns about how this looks. And there's already been some preliminary results, which have kind of been kind of meh, if that's the right word. But, you know, this is another thing. I think it describes a lot of patients' experience after having COVID. I think it's important in that sense just to kind of see what the patterns are like. And I've, you know, frankly, Fred, I've taken care of a couple patients with symptoms. It's hard to know. You know, I remember sitting with a resident with one of them and just trying to think, like, what else? You know, we talk about something called our differential diagnosis, Fred, which is, okay, let's just kind of think of the list of possibilities and see what fits and what doesn't fit and kind of go through that. And as we were working through this patient, I'm writing them down on a whiteboard that's in our clinic, and I took up the whole wall. It's a really thorny thing to think through, because I really see it as a diagnosis almost of exclusion. Meaning that, you know, I'm willing to say that once we've kind of ruled out some other things that could cause a lot of these symptoms. And so I think the most interesting thing, Fred, we're going to have to deal with in the next 3 to 4 years with COVID is the healthcare expense, not just with treating it, but with these kind of follow-up complaints and people not feeling well and the disability that they're having and, you know, the time they're missed from work and the testing that they'll undergo and the medical treatments they'll have. you know, that's going to be an expensive proposition, to put it mildly. So I think getting some of this data is really helpful. My healthy skepticism is always at 11, so to speak, and I'd like to see more and more good quality evidence come out before I can kind of give great advice about what to expect.
I got my flu shot last weekend at the Brew in the Loo event in
Excellent.
Francis Park, and it's, you know, no problems at all. But I see that 49% of American adults plan to get it, so less than half of the population plan to get a flu shot. How needed might the flu shot be this season?
Well, we recommend it every year, and the reason why is the same thing we recommend the COVID vaccines is people get sick and people die. The number hovers around 30,000 a year, and you know that's a substantial number of people that get sick. Or you know, 30,000 is the number that pass, but the many more get sick and require hospitalization, and some of that's you know we can reduce those things with a flu vaccine. You know, a couple of myths I just always kind of talk about. One is, you know, people say they get the flu vaccine and they get sick afterwards, or they get the flu because of the vaccine. I just want to emphasize that's what I call correlation, not a causation. You know, just because, you know, on average, people get 6 viral illnesses a year, by the sheer math, when you do a mass immunization, I guess when you're giving mass vaccinations to a huge number of people, the sheer probability of some people being sick kind of at the time or getting sick shortly after the time that they get the vaccine is just, it's a math problem. It's not caused by the flu vaccine. They just happen to get a virus and it started to manifest right after the time that they got the vaccine. And again, it is safe. It does confer some protection for you. And, you know, like we're offering it to everybody that we see in clinic and we'll continue to do so. So I'm glad you got yours and I encourage everybody to get theirs as well too. I'll be honest, I've been a bad person. I still haven't gotten mine, but I'll be getting mine next week.
Sounds good. Dr. Buchholz, thanks so much for your time again this week. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem, Fred.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU Care General Internist at SSM Health, St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up next on Health Matters, we'll hear from Dr. Ashish Jha with the latest on the flu shot and those new COVID boosters. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first 3 orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify is got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on KMOX.
The Biden administration is encouraging more Americans to get the updated COVID-19 booster. White House COVID-19 response coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha says the new vaccine will help save lives ahead of an unexpected uptick in infections this winter.
Families around the country are starting to make plans for Thanksgiving. Mine is. We're thinking about the holidays ahead. It's going to be here sooner than most people know. And we're all looking forward to a really good holiday season. The challenge with holiday seasons every year is it's also a time where contagious respiratory viruses like influenza, RSV, and again this year, COVID, spread much more quickly. And we have seen an increase in COVID infections, hospitalizations, and deaths each of the last two winters. And we are carefully monitoring the rise of several subvariants that are evolving rapidly and emerging around the world, including ones that evade some of our treatments. And given what we've seen in Australia this summer, our summer, their winter, it's reasonable to expect we're going to see a significant flu season this year. So we have some challenges ahead as we plan and as we look at the winter in front of us. But the good news is we are not helpless against these challenges, right? In fact, what happens in the weeks and months ahead will have a large impact on how the winter goes. And really what happens in this winter is largely up to us as the American people. So let me talk about what tools we have, what we can do to make sure we have a safe and healthy fall, winter, holiday season. We have updated bivalent vaccines that target both the original version of COVID from 2020, as well as Omicron, the BA5 version that's circulating right now. And based on everything we know about immunology and science and vaccines, these updated vaccines should provide a much higher level of protection against infection, against transmission, and certainly against serious illness and hospitalizations and deaths. And just like people get the flu shot each year, even if you've had the flu in the past or if you got a flu shot the year before, it's really critical that everyone 12 and older should go get this updated annual COVID-19 vaccine. So you're protected this fall and winter, and you're protected year round. So my message today from this briefing room is very simple. Don't wait. Get your new flu shot and get your new COVID shot today. If Americans did that, we could save hundreds of lives each day this winter. As the Commonwealth Fund just put out a new report, a new analysis, they estimate that we can save as many as 90,000 lives and nearly a million hospitalizations if most eligible Americans got their updated vaccines. Now, that is just based on vaccines alone, which are remarkable and going to make a very large difference. But if we do better than that, if people get tested when they have symptoms, we know testing leads to a diagnosis, diagnosis leads to treatments. And treatments that we have available today for free keep people out of the hospital, keep people out of the ICU, prevent the worst outcome of all. And here is the most remarkable fact. 2.5 years into this pandemic, think about where we were in March of 2020. Here's the most remarkable fact. If you are up to date with your vaccines, and if you get treated, if you have a breakthrough infection, your risk of dying from COVID is now close to zero. So as we look ahead to our third winter of COVID-19, we are focused like a laser on bringing down serious illness and deaths. And the single most important thing people can do to protect themselves, to protect their families, to protect their communities, is to get the updated COVID-19 vaccine. We're making it very clear that getting these updated vaccines can save your life, because we know these vaccines are safe and they are effective. And beyond vaccines, let me make one other clear point, because there's a lot of confusion when you go on social media. Lots of people like to pontificate on what the data says, so let me be very clear about the evidence. If you are over 50 or otherwise at elevated risk and you get infected, you should be seriously considered for treatments, because treatments are effective, they make a big difference, they can save your life. In terms of when's a good time to get vaccinated, I've been very clear about this. I think people should go get vaccinated before Halloween. Why Halloween? Because it takes a couple of weeks for your immune system to, kind of generate the benefit from that vaccine. And that means you will be ready by Thanksgiving and certainly by the holidays. If you miss the Halloween, is it too late? It's not too late. again, it takes a couple of weeks for the immune system to benefit from the vaccine. So there's no time period where the window is out and you're no longer going to benefit. You will always benefit. But the bottom line is, if you do it before Thanksgiving, you're going to see family and friends. Before the holidays, a lot of socializing that goes on in December. It's going to be a really good time to get it done before Halloween.
Dr. Ashish Jha is the White House COVID-19 Response Coordinator. Coming up next on Health Matters, we'll take a closer look at some surprise findings from a new study about the effectiveness of colonoscopies. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on KMOX.
A new European colonoscopy study has left some wondering if they should have the procedure. Here to talk with us about that study is Washington University and Siteman Cancer Center oncologist, Dr. Nicholas Tricholinas. Dr. Tricholinas, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's so good to talk to you, and hello to your audience.
So what do we need to know about this new study?
So this is a big study, a randomized study that happened in Europe. It essentially tried to figure out if colonoscopy works and how well it works. So in three countries, the researchers just decided to offer colonoscopy to some people and just follow some others. The offer was a one-time invitation. Some of those people ended up getting the colonoscopy. The others declined it. So after a long period of time, they just tried to understand whether cancer detection rates were higher, whether people lived longer, whether cancer was prevented. So what they found out was that the risk of colorectal cancer, dying from colorectal cancer, did not change between the two groups of people, the ones that were offered a colonoscopy and the ones that were not offered a colonoscopy. But the reality is only 40%, 42% of those patients that were offered a colonoscopy ended up getting one. So the data has been diluted to a certain amount. When you actually look at the patients who got a colonoscopy, they did benefit from that. So when people actually looked into the patients that received a colonoscopy versus the patients that did not, the risk of incidence of colorectal cancer was decreased by 31%, and the risk of dying from colorectal cancer decreased by 50%. Moreover, people who actually received a colonoscopy had adenomas, you know, those premalignant cancer lesions seen in about 30% of the cases. Those people were probably spared from getting a diagnosis of colorectal cancer in the future. Overall, people who were in the invited group have fewer cases of colorectal cancer versus the ones that actually decided not to have a colonoscopy. So the study doesn't really tell us that colonoscopy doesn't work. It tells us, however, that we need to be more intent in pursuing colonoscopy or at least a screening test for colorectal cancer because people are very hesitant to do it. It also tells us that colonoscopies are safe. Very few people had side effects from the colonoscopies, and virtually nobody had something tragic happen to them. This is in accordance with what we've seen in the past about colonoscopies. What we've learned from this study is that the efficacy of colonoscopy may not be what we thought in the past, but it's definitely a very good screening test. It's not the only one, but definitely a very good test.
So the takeaway is not to see this study as saying don't get a colonoscopy, but there is a real need to get one.
That is correct. A colonoscopy or any screening test for a cancer has the potential to prevent the cancer from happening, curing that cancer. And I cannot stress how important that is. I wish we had a preventative test or a screening test for most cancers, and we don't. But colonoscopy is relatively safe and easy. It's not the most fun test to do. You know, no one wakes up in the morning thinking they're going to have a colonoscopy and be happy about it, but it's definitely very useful in preventing colorectal cancer, and that is all the more important in people who have a family history of cancer or who have inflammatory diseases that may predispose them to certain kinds of cancers. I'm a cancer physician, and we see a lot of colorectal cancer patients, and more alarmingly, we see more and more young patients lately. And that's why the recommendations, the age that's appropriate for beginning of colonoscopies has been lowered to 45 years of age. And we want to prevent that. I mean, literally, we want you guys to put us out of business. That's why we're in favor of screening tests. And I have personal experience of that. You know, both of my parents had cancer. One of them was screened and actually prevented cancer. She's still alive. The other one had a cancer for which there's no screening test and actually expired. That was my father. So I'm very much in favor of any test that can essentially decrease your chance of developing a life-threatening disease, you know, and being stuck with chemotherapy, hospital visits, surgery, radiation, all those sorts of things.
We're talking with WashU and Siteman Cancer Center oncologist Dr. Nicholas Tricolinas. Dr. Tricolinas, I read somewhere that colonoscopies in Europe are done without sedation.
That is correct, and I didn't want to touch on that subject. Let's just put it this way. There's definitely a difference in the way we do colonoscopies in the U.S. and in the rest of the world. In the U.S., there's a focus on comfort. There's propofol or other sedation that happens. Some people have a little memory of what happened, and that's much more comfortable for them. In Europe or in Japan, you actually do not sedate routinely your patients, and that might have been one of the reasons for the refusal of people to get a colonoscopy in the first place, even if they were invited to. This is also reflected in other studies that are currently happening. For example, a Swedish study has a very low accrual rate to about 30%, 30 to 35%. So I completely understand why fewer people were very interested in colonoscopies in Europe. At the same time, there were no established colonoscopy screening tests, government mandated or encouraged in Europe. And there's definitely a lot more interest in promoting preventative care in the U.S. right now, with help from celebrities, with help from people who have a large audience. And I think that's very appropriate. I think that's one of the biggest take-home messages from this study, that people need to be aware of the need for preventative testing and to be assured that it's a safe procedure and we'll make it as comfortable as possible.
You know, I had a colonoscopy a couple of years ago. I don't remember a thing about it. It was, you know, I went in, I was sedated, came out, and, you know, it was just like going to sleep, so there was no problem at all. I wanted to ask you about colonoscopy being the gold standard. What if you don't want to get the colonoscopy? What other options are there?
So one of the things that this study is questioning is whether colonoscopy is actually the gold standard. For now, we believe it is, but there are options in people who are hesitant, and this would be the home test, such as the fecal-occult blood test. That's a stool test. That's much more comfortable. Obviously, it helps detect certain premalignant lesions, but doesn't take them out. Ultimately, a colonoscopy may be needed in the future, but I would say anything is better than nothing. And whether those tests are better, worse, or the same as colonoscopy, well, that's what science is about. There are two or three ongoing studies looking at that. We will know more in the future. No one knows the absolute truth, and God forbid that we state that we do right now. But what we do is strive to find a better way to care for our patients. That's what I love about medicine. That's what I love about clinical trials.
Who is at increased risk for colon cancer?
In general, we feel that people with a strong family history of colon cancer, people with certain genetic mutations that may be passed on through generations, may be at higher risk. So if you have a lot of family members with colon cancers, that's definitely a red flag, and you should talk to your doctor about it. People with chronic inflammatory conditions, colitis, such as Crohn's colitis, may be at higher risk for colon cancer. And then anybody who randomly has a colonoscopy for a different reason, say blood in their stool, and they end up having adenomas, which are those premalignant lesions, they should be followed more closely. And always, anybody who has a new onset of symptoms that look weird or unusual, consistent abdominal pain, blood in their stool that just doesn't go away, or any other systemic symptoms associated with those, they should probably seek guidance from their doctors and perhaps get a colonoscopy.
And doctor, one more time, how important is it to catch this cancer at its earliest stages?
It is absolutely important that you detect cancer at an early stage because you can get rid of it. You can cure it. Colon cancer can have a long history from a small adenoma, small polyp, to a full-fledged metastatic disease that will be very hard to treat. But when caught early, it is 100% curable, and that's magnificent. That is wonderful about this problem, that you can actually prevent it if you get lucky enough and if it's detected at an early stage. So I would advise anybody who is eligible for a colonoscopy, and that would be, for now, anybody 45 years or older, to strongly consider that and talk to someone who's had a colonoscopy if they're really worried about the procedure.
Dr. Tricolinas, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Nicholas Tricolinas is an oncologist at Washington University and Siteman Cancer Center. Coming up next on Health Matters, we'll talk about auditory processing problems as a result of a stroke. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on KMOX.
How common is the auditory processing problem Pennsylvania Democrat Senate candidate John Fetterman is now dealing with following his stroke back in May?
I'll hear someone speaking, but sometimes I'll be able to be precise on what exactly that they're saying. I use captioning.
Here to tell us more about that is Dr. Nita Jamal. Dr. Jamal is the Stroke Medical Director at Mercy St. Louis. Dr. Jamal, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
So, what is an auditory processing issue?
Well, it can result from a stroke. What happens is that you have your hearing apparatus, which is your ear, and then you have a center in your brain, mainly in the temporal lobe, which processes everything that you hear in relation to your memories, in relation to your past experiences, and then kind of translates that for you so that you're better able to understand the sounds that you're hearing.
How common is it to have this problem after a stroke?
It is actually not very common. It can happen, but it's not one of the most common symptoms of stroke that I see.
What are some of the common symptoms?
So the most common would be weakness on one side, can be numbness on one side, can be problems with a production of words, which is known as aphasia, or can be problems with understanding words. These are the most common symptoms of strokes that we see.
Let's go back to the auditory processing problem. How is that treated?
Well, like any other stroke symptom, that is treated with rehab. So it depends on how severe it is. Say a patient comes in with weakness, they're sent to acute rehab. Patients don't know how to use their hands to write. They have therapy done. It's either occupational therapy or physical therapy that's done to help them. I would think with problems such as auditory processing problem, it would be along the same lines, but just different techniques to help the patient understand exactly what's happening and how to cope with it.
How long can the recovery process for something like that take?
That all depends. It's really difficult to pin a timeline on the recovery process. Younger patients have a tendency to recover much faster from strokes than older patients. And again, it depends on how fast acute rehab starts immediately after the stroke. The sooner it starts, the better the chances of recovery.
Do a lot of the people who are dealing with this use captions to help them understand what's being said to them?
Again, like I said, patients with auditory processing need to develop certain techniques to help them understand things better. And if using captions is one of them, then it's very much possible that that's what they can use.
But this is a processing issue and not a comprehension one. Tell us the difference.
No.
What's the difference?
The difference is the patient who has an auditory processing, they are hearing the sounds, but the brain is unable to translate those sounds into their past experiences, their memories, and make them understand it. If, say, they have a coping mechanism of reading it out, they're able to understand it. But it's just the connection between the hearing, which is the ears, and the part of the brain that processes all of the sound, that is the part that is affected in a stroke with these patients. But is their understanding intact? More than likely it is.
I'm reading that recovery from strokes can take 3 to 6 months, maybe even up to 18 months. Does most recovery occur at a certain time, or can it just be spread out for months?
It can be spread out. It can be spread out. Like I said, it depends on how severe the stroke symptoms are. We see patients which are completely paralyzed on one side. Obviously, those symptoms will take much longer to recover from. If it is something as mild as just a right hand weakness, that can probably recover much faster. But the emphasis should always be on the sooner the acute rehab starts to take place, the better it is in terms of recovery.
We're talking with Dr. Nita Jamal, the stroke medical director at Mercy St. Louis. Dr. Jamal, what are the different types of strokes people can have?
Well, the two basic types of strokes is when there is bleeding in the brain. That's one. And then the more common one is when blood supply to a certain part of the brain is blocked off, either due to a little clot that's traveled up there. And these are the two basic types of strokes that we have.
And tell us about what's called mini strokes.
Mini strokes is what we put it in layman's terms. Those are called TIAs in our medical terminology. Those are referred to as transient ischemic attacks. What happens is that patient experiences certain neurological deficits, such as a weakness or numbness or vision problems, for a few hours or a few minutes, and then it completely resolves. For these patients, and the MRI of the brain that is done, which is an imaging of the brain that shows strokes, that is negative for mini strokes. Whereas for actual strokes, you have findings on those MRIs.
So tell us again, what should we do if we're having some symptoms? How do we know when to just weather the storm or when to seek help?
So we go by this criteria called BFAST, where it is that any sudden change in your neurological exam, such as you start slurring your words, and it is something that should happen abruptly. It should happen within a few seconds. So slurring of words, you notice that your mouth is drooping on one side more than the other. You notice your entire arm is tingling and numb when it shouldn't be, or you're unable to walk. You have weakness in your arms or your legs. These are sudden symptoms which should make you concerned enough that you should approach or call EMS and come to the hospital for evaluation.
And how is the evaluation done? What happens once you get to the hospital?
So, for example, here at Mercy Hospital, the patient comes in as a stroke patient. The entire team is activated. The patient is taken to a CT scanner. A patient neurological examination is done thoroughly from head to toe to determine how strong those deficits are. And depending upon that, treatment decisions are made.
Does it matter where you go for treatment? Are there stroke centers that we need to know about?
So I think all hospitals can do the basic triage, but there are certain main hospitals that can do interventional procedures to treat stroke symptoms, which are known as thrombectomies, or giving them a clot-busting medication such as TPA. So those are preferably the best hospitals to go to. But obviously, if you're living in smaller towns, it's difficult to access those bigger hospitals. But definitely, one should get evaluated in an emergency department immediately.
What are the risk factors for stroke?
Basic risk factors, diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol levels, smoking is a factor. There is a risk factor which is known as atrial fibrillation. That is abnormal heart rhythm. It causes the heart to not beat as rhythmically as it should, and it tends to form clots in the heart. And then even something like sleep apnea is a risk factor for stroke.
Dr. Jamal, what's the final message you want listeners to take away from this interview?
Be aware of your own body, of any changes in your body. If anybody has any sudden change or not feeling good, please approach the ED, please approach the hospitals. That's what we are there for. Because stroke is something which, if caught in time, it can be treated. Stroke is a treatable neurological disease. Caught in time, it's treated, and patients do well after that. So time is of the essence when it comes to stroke.
Dr. Jamal, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Nita Jamal is the Stroke Medical Director at Mercy St. Louis. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If there are parts of this show you want to hear again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the Odyssey app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week for another edition of Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Now, with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Tip, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.